Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Today is March 29, 2012, and I thank you so much for listening to these free, informative broadcasts. We really do these shows so that you will be educated, informed, and take action. Get involved in your local, state, and community in terms of protecting your rights. So you can be part of this educational movement by telling your friends to listen to the show, send them an email with a link, tweet it on Twitter, post the share button on Facebook, Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, MySpace, or copy the embed code of the show and place the show right onto your website or blog. Favorite the show and become a regular listener and click the reminder button. You can contact myself at homeopathyworldcommunity@gmail.com or you can contact Alan. Go to his website, vaccinerights.com. Is there another way that you would like people to contact you?
Well, that's the best way, but there's all the contact information available there, Debbie, email, telephone, mail, all the ways you can get me, short of showing up in person at my P.O. box. So
okay.
Waiting for me there. But
well, I'm very, very honored to have you on the show every week, every Thursday at noon, because of your you're just an advocate for the rest of the people in the community and keeping ahead of the news, because not everyone is so devoted and involved in what's going on in the legislative part of their life. They just want to get day to day, you know, be able to go to work, get their food, come home, feed their family, you know, get their kids to school. And you're out there plugging away for those folks who don't have the time to do all of this other stuff.
Well, and it's interesting too, Debbie, because not only do most of us not have the time to keep up with this or the myriad of issues that ideally we'd all like to be on top of and involved with, or would, especially if we knew the difficulties going on. That's a condition, I think, that fosters a lot of the complexity, the difficulties that we have going on in the first place. It's sort of, as I was organizing my thoughts this morning before talking to a health committee with the Vermont legislature, I was organizing my thoughts and thinking about how do you explain to a group of legislators that the information they're hearing from the experts is incomplete or wrong or misleading. That's a really difficult sell. And yet, as I was thinking about this, you know, to the extent that I'm aware of doctors who have personally and individually researched the topic, I know of no doctors who, among those who have a mainstream view on vaccination. And what that reveals to me is that information, and in our society generally, is largely controlled in centralized ways. That is, doctors get their information from sources that they trust, and so they don't individually go out and research vaccinations or other things. Or to the extent that they do, they'll read the conclusions and summaries of published medical studies. But we know from past shows and information we've talked about that even that is not something that we can fully rely on anymore. So to the extent that information is controlled in a centralized way, and it is substantially in the healthcare arena, and other arenas as well, is the extent to which complete information may not be there. Because if someone has central control of information, there is always the potential and certainly the temptation to use that ability or that power that to influence people for a political agenda, which may be one that is different from or in stark contrast to an actual objective scientific or moral ethical agenda.
Well, you're following up very well. In our last show, we were talking about getting information as to what are the ingredients, what is the makeup of the food in cat and dog food. And, you know, basically it comes down to finding a reliable source of information, somebody that you can trust, somebody that you can communicate with, because as I suggested, well, you could just call the company and find out. But even then, you have to go on a wild goose chase to find out where the company is getting the distribution of their ingredients from, and then calling more and more companies down the line, which means you would spend a lot of time trying to find out what the ingredients are in that can. And therefore, the same way with legislative action, who do you speak to? Who is going to be your reliable source of information that you can trust is on top of it? It seems that it's an individual responsibility today, and the fact that mainstream media, you said centralized source of information, that it's changed today with social networking. As we have the internet and people posting their findings, you can go and search and investigate, research whatever information you like out there.
You can, and that's an enormous advantage for the cause of liberty or informed choice. But there's a separate question as to who is actually doing that, first of all. And there are also psychological barriers separate and apart from the information control, which often keep people from seeing an objective view. You know, in the vaccine arena, what if these anti-vaccine people are actually right? The implications of that question are enormous. If the anti-vaccine people are substantially correct, then we've been led down a garden path for decades with vaccines. We've endured thousands, if not millions, of unnecessary death and disability from vaccines that would not have happened with the infectious diseases in any proportion if we hadn't been vaccinating, comparable proportion if we hadn't been vaccinating. Pharmaceutical industry execs, if not certainly not the entire population of pharmaceutical employees by any means, but some of the executives and some of the top people in the CDC must know that this is happening and are doing nothing about it, and the industry is profiting from it. These are enormous implications that most people just aren't prepared to accept emotionally and intellectually, not prepared to even consider as possibilities. Nobody would really do that. You've got to be out of your mind. And so there, you know, the access to information is absolutely a critical piece, and the internet is very promising in that regard. People have to learn to scrutinize information, whatever side of whatever issue you're on. You've got to scrutinize it all carefully. But there are, separate and apart from the information source issues, the psychological barriers to really look openly and objectively at the vaccine question. You have to allow, regardless of where you eventually end up in terms of your conclusions, you have to allow really broad possibilities, and that's something that I think most people in our society today are not yet prepared to fully do.
Well, it comes down to also the time element that we were discussing earlier at the beginning, that you have to find somebody who you trust, who is reliable with sources of information, and that's why I always call you if there's something in regard to the vaccine issue. And the NVIC organization, they can tell you what's going on legislatively in all of the states in the United States. And I suppose, are there other places which you would recommend finding information internationally, what's happening?
I see a lot of information come across my screen because of my involvement and membership in vaccine Yahoo groups, Facebook pages. I have clients and other contacts who from time to time will email me information. There are a number of activists who have their own independent list that they send information out to. So if you reach out to some of these more immediate sources, you can connect in with others, and you'll find at some point that there's a pretty good flow of information within the alternative vaccine community. So if you plug into any main piece of that, and again, Facebook or Yahoo groups are real good ways to do that, you'll find that you see a large part of the information flow within the broader alternative community. I am very deliberately connected with many of these different sources, so necessarily I see a lot of redundancy in the information that comes my way as a result, but I also see a lot of information that I would have missed if I did not go ahead and connect in a way that I also get the redundancy of information. So I'm trying to get as broad a stream as I can manage, frankly.
And we would also, you know, I really do acknowledge people who believe in vaccinations. I think that they have a right to do what they want with their body. And if this is what they want to do, that's fine. And they can collaborate with the people who also believe in vaccinations. And the only thing that I feel is necessary is freedom of choice, that the full information should be out there, that if you believe one thing, let's hear it. If you believe another thing, let's hear that too. And then let the individual make their life choice for themselves and their family.
Well, and it really does come down in one sense to that simple of a conclusion for me as well, Debbie. If anyone tries to substitute their view for another view, we're just perpetuating the problem. The problem that we have in one sense is that we have delegated our own decision-making authority and ability to others who then have taken advantage of that. And in order to avoid being taken advantage of, we have to claim responsibility for making our own decisions. I wanted to follow up real quick, though. I didn't mean to suggest that I think anybody who wants to be informed on this issue needs to go join every Yahoo group and Facebook page they can find. Rather, folks who don't have that kind of time can get really quick information. In terms of news, there are many sources for vaccine news. I'm going to blow my own horn here for a second, but there are many others as well. The Pandemic Response Project has a news page that's updated every day or two, and I take what I think to be some of the most important vaccine or vaccine-related news items. I do have a focus on legal and political aspects, but when something like we'll discuss in a little bit here today, comes through that is of real importance in a medical certainly scientific sense, but medical sense in particular, I'll, of course, bring that in too. So the pandemicresponseproject.com, that webpage's news page, is a great way to get a quick overview of vaccine news without having to go to the extra time and effort that I've gone to pull that together for you. And as you mentioned, Debbie, the NVIC, National Vaccine Information Center, they have an advocacy portal, which is a exquisitely designed project where people can sign up for free and keep tabs on what's going on with regard to vaccine legislation in their state and other states, and only vaccine legislation. It doesn't deal with any other topic. And there is legislation going on around the country. Many, many different states have pending legislation having to do with one aspect or another of the vaccine issue. So I definitely encourage people to get on there. If you want to be involved but don't know how and don't have time, the vaccine NVIC's advocacy portal is the way to go.
Okay, so You wanted to talk today about some issue happening in Vermont?
Yes, Vermont has a pending bill which, if passed, will remove the right to a philosophical exemption for vaccines. The bill was passed by a pretty substantial majority in the state Senate and is now being considered by the House. If it passes the House, then it will go on to the governor for his signature. So it's gotten through the Senate. So those of us in the alternative community who would like to see freedom of choice preserved in Vermont are very concerned about that. I had the great honor and privilege of being invited to testify, to be among a list of people in recent days this week who are each given about a half an hour to present testimony and field questions from a House Health Care Committee. And so I did that this morning, and I thought what we could do, Debbie, is take a look at some of the notes that the draft paper that I sent them. I mean, the question, what's the answer to the question, what's wrong with vaccines, is encyclopedic in volume. And I had to figure out how best to encapsulate at least some of the most important points as concisely as I could in order to present a case, essentially, for keeping the philosophical exemption. Now, predictably, health authorities, perhaps if not exclusively from inside Vermont, including, of course, the Department of Health folks, have been getting up in front of this committee and explaining how terrible it would be if we kept the philosophical exemption and how horrible disease outbreaks could happen at any time, and we really need to close this loophole, and how many people are actually not doing vaccines, and so forth and so on. That's a pretty tall order to get up as a non-medical person to be in front. I did this by telephone, by the way, to be in front of a committee as a non-medical person and essentially, bottom line, arguing why they should not do what the medical people are recommending. Now, I feel sure there are some science and medical folks who are against this bill who support keeping the philosophical exemption. But again, it's a pretty tall order. And so I approached it not from the point of view of I know the medicine better than the medical people, but from a different point of view. And I asked the committee to consider three different distinctions, given that by the time I got in front of them, they had heard a lot of conflicting information, as I'm sure they had. Now, I haven't been listening to the testimony they've received, but I've heard some reports of it and seen some of it, and it is along the lines of what we would expect. Disease outbreaks around the country, you know, things are, you know, everybody's about to die, let's get rid of the philosophical exemption. You know, really, and I suspect most of these people believe what they're saying and really believe that this is a true public health issue, and that perhaps we are on the verge of some kind of emergency, you know, if we keep allowing the exemption and so forth. And
does the health status in Vermont make them feel that this is a necessity to remove a philosophical exemption, which seems to me, under the law, under our Constitution, a right for everyone?
Well, the truth of the matter is, as a legal technicality, whether we like it or not, and I really don't like it, frankly, but we have no constitutional right to refuse vaccines. I have heard stories about a healthcare, some sort of fundamental healthcare right being on the table when the Constitution was drafted and ultimately ended up on the cutting room floor. As much as we might think we should have the right, we don't. And that's just the current state of the law. And so we are left to arguing positions at the legislative level, because if there's not a fundamental right that takes care of that for us, then we need to pass laws giving us that right. So that's kind of the practical, the legal technicality and practical reality. But I attempted, or my plan or position, strategy, whatever you want to call it, was to position myself, and I think appropriately and fairly, as a vaccine exemption and waiver expert and an expert in vaccine politics. And the first thing I ask these folks to do is to consider a distinction between the medical and non-medical aspects of of the issue. And that's a fairly simple, straightforward concept. It's the idea that we know that vaccines kill and disable. Vaccines cause death and permanent disability. And we also know that doctors can't tell you in advance whether your child's going to be the next victim, the next vaccine victim. And so we're left, if we go no farther than that, we're left with this utilitarian idea. Should the individual be forced to incur a risk of injury or death for the presumed benefit of the whole? And just on that level, reasonable people disagree. Some people say, well, you know, of course the individual should subvert their personal liberty to the benefit of the whole. But other people say, well, no, wait a minute, you're talking about life and death here. This is something that really is an individual liberty issue. So without having to resolve that one way or the other, the fact that reasonable people will disagree on that, that in and of itself bodes in support of having the philosophical exemption so that we preserve both sides of that utilitarian issue. However, if you scrutinize this benefit of the whole presumption, because that whole utilitarian thing presumes that the risk for the individual has a benefit for society, you scrutinize that benefit of the whole, it just really doesn't hold up. And there's two pieces to that in my argument for the Vermont legislature. The first one is that the pro-vaccine folks always come in and say, yes, there are, you know, the occasional injury or death, but that is far better than all the deaths we'd get if we weren't vaccinating. And to make that kind of a cost-benefit assessment, you have to have good data. You have to have good numbers on the deaths caused by the diseases and on the adverse events caused by the vaccines. And the bottom line is that CDC, FDA, and other officials say that 90 to 99% of vaccine harm is not reported. And we know that 90 to 95% of infectious disease decline preceded vaccines. So we don't know what the death rate would be from diseases without vaccines. Right. And we don't know what the harm from the vaccines is.
So it comes back to the principle and discussion at the beginning of the show that decisions, life and death decisions, are being made upon facts, figures, information that is being fed to the legislators, to decision makers, to people who are of influence, to authorities, to medical organizations, to the World Health Organization, to all of these different groups and people and individuals, that what information is actually factual? What is the truth? And if they're going to base the decisions, the legislative decisions about law, they have to have all of that information. And if they're being influenced by whether it is money or whether it is powerful lobbies, whoever is going to direct the flow of information, that's going to make a difference in what the individual rights outcome will be.
That's right. And you know, I'm not going to try to go through every single point in the outline here, Debbie. We just don't have time for that. But at the end of my presentation, I got a question, and the question was essentially, you know, if what you're saying here, if we, you know, accept what you're saying, you know, we have the authority to just completely remove the mandate altogether. Is that what you're suggesting? You know, and I said, wasn't really expecting that one. And my response,
removing the mandate to do what?
Mandate for vaccines altogether, but there was a tone. There was a tone of voice in the question that did not indicate that. That they would seriously consider that.
I think it was
a little more. A little more of a come on, give me a break kind of attitude. Now maybe I'm hearing that wrong, but that's how I read it. And my response was that my goal, you know, today in presenting this information is not to resolve the issue. In fact, I propose to them that they relieve themselves of the burden of trying to resolve the issue altogether. My point is that it's an inherently complex issue, that there are that there is a legitimate controversy, and that the conversation is what needs to be preserved. And by removing the philosophical exemption, government is imposing one side of a multi-sided, multifaceted, inherently complex issue. And so I was arguing for continuing the conversation, not shutting it down by removing the philosophical exemption. But just a couple of quick points, if I may, because I know there's other things we want to talk about. The second distinction I asked them to make was a distinction between medical science and medical politics. And my strategy was essentially this. I'm going to present a lot of information that's contrary to what the medical people are presenting, or at least most of them. And I know in advance that I'm not a medical person. I don't have the credibility or the credentials to back it up. And if I were in their shoes and was not already informed on this issue, I would be a lot more comfortable going with the medical people. Because if I'm wrong and I do what the medical people say, I can blame it on the medical people. But if I'm wrong and I don't do what the medical people say, it's going to be my fault. So that's, you know, what I would be thinking in their shoes. And my point is this, that, you know, why is it that I'm giving you all this information that contradicts what they're telling you? Why aren't they giving you that same information? Because my information comes from authoritative sources, CDC, FDA, congressional testimony of medical experts, and I've cited meticulously every assertion I made. I have, I think, 21 different, I have a two-page argument and then a full third page with 21 different references, mostly medical literature and congressional testimony kinds of things. And so I was trying to offer them a distinction, you know, the distinction between medical politics and medical science. And if we can understand that because of the medical politics, medical policy at the state and federal level is in some instances skewed because it's influenced by medical politics and not always objective medical science, then we can see that there's a need at the state level to keep a door open for alternative views. It's a check and balance, if you will, of the system. I'm not sure whether or not or how successfully I conveyed that concern, but that was my certainly my intent, and we'll see where they go with it. There were many people testifying on both sides, and it's got to be a difficult decision.
Right. So they accepted your testimony, and one of the responses was a little bit sarcastic. But were, do you feel other people were intently listening to the possibility and perhaps opening up to the fact that so many experts in the field of medicine and vaccines in the research area and the injury response teams, you know, adverse effects, are they coming to new conclusions, do you think, or possibly?
Well, in my particular case, that was the only question I got. They had been asking in other testimony, the feedback I got suggested they'd been asking people about religious exemption and other things, and I thought, gee, I'm the ideal person to throw those questions to. And for whatever reason or combination of reasons, that was the one question I got. So that's the only indication I got of where they were. And it was a real mixed response because the fact that, the question was, that particular question was given is an indication that they heard everything I said. If you're saying, well, you know, if we listen to you, we might as well just get rid of the mandate altogether, they heard what I said. The question is, are they able to take that in as part of the total consideration, or does it just, you know, did I go too far? This is a question we have all the time on the alternative community. Anytime we're presenting information with regard to whoever our audience is, the question, the strategic question, the strategy question is, what can you present that will get the job done, and how do you go that far but no farther to avoid the risk of going so far that you just go beyond what they can possibly take in and you just get completely dismissed altogether?
That makes really good sense. One of the things is it's on the record, is it not? So
yes.
Anybody who goes back to read the notes can go back and see the input that you have provided.
That's true. I mean, there is a record there now. in Vermont, and again, I was just real pleased and honored to have been a part of it. So it's hard to know. I mean, only one person spoke out in terms of, you know, that question, and that represented perhaps one or more, who knows, you know, in terms of the position. For all I know, there was somebody else sitting there quietly saying, oh, my God, I didn't realize all of this. This is crazy. So, I mean, either way, I mean, they could have been saying this is crazy in that they just couldn't take it in at all, or there's, you know, maybe I opened some eyes and someone is saying, I had no idea about this. I mean, there were other people testifying before me who covered, I'm sure, a lot of the same material. That was the impression I had from the question as well, or the comments and questions that I got, that I wasn't the first one in there making these kind of cases. I'm sure, just as kind of a, statistically, if nothing else, the odds are really good that at least some of my information was new.
Did you want to provide on the show today some of the points?
Well, I'll talk about some. A lot of these are ones that are a summary of a lot of past information. So we have talked about a lot of these, but I'll give a few quick points. I talked about the fact that the vast majority of infectious disease decline preceded vaccines. I talked about how the majority of our population today is adult baby boomers who haven't been vaccinated in decades. And so if herd immunity was really true, because vaccine protection only lasts a few years, 2 to 10 years is the prevailing belief about that right now, well over half our population has no vaccine protection and hasn't had any for decades. And if you had to be vaccinated to prevent diseases, we'd have diseases all over the place. We don't have that. I talked about how polio was actually not eliminated by vaccines, that the Public Health Service, bottom line, and I don't know any real polite way to say this, perpetrated a fraud on the American public. They changed the definitions so that it looks like polio declined when, in fact, it went up after the vaccine was introduced. I talked about how in the U.S. today, the majority of non-immune children are vaccinated children because, as the CDC tells us, 5 to 15% of vaccine recipients don't generate antibodies in response to the vaccine. And that's a substantially larger number than the number of exempt people. So if the issue here really is who is immune and who isn't, we need to be looking at the vaccinated kids because there are more of them who are not immune than there are exempt kids who are not immune.
And the kids who have not been immunized, they have what kind of protections? Their own immunity from getting the disease, or their immunity from being of higher health to begin with?
Well, not everybody who's exposed to a disease gets sick, and even the CDC acknowledges that you can get natural immunity without even having symptoms. So some vaccinated kids will get the disease and they'll develop immunity that way, but other people will have immunity without even ever getting sick. And, you know, we don't understand all there is to know about immunity today, and we'll talk about that in a minute when we get to that really interesting natural news article that you brought to my attention.
Okay.
So we're always learning more, but we pretend with vaccine policy that we already know it all, and this is how it works, get your vaccine and shut up, and it's just not that simple. But I also talked about how despite having the best health care in the world, and we give more vaccines than any other country, we are, according to the CAA fact book, 49th in infant mortality. Now, the UN has a different number of 34th, and I don't know how those numbers are so different. But the point is that we have a third world infant mortality rate here in the U.S. How do you explain that when we have the world's best healthcare systems and we give more vaccines than anybody else? And in fact, there was a study last year that showed that the more vaccines a nation gives, the higher the infant mortality rate tends to be. So that's not proof of causation, but it's a darn good reason to be, you know, asking questions and looking further. I mentioned how there's a PACE environmental law review article that found that the vaccine injury compensation program has been compensating kids, vaccine-injured kids with autism for over more than two decades, about how studies have shown that a 1% increase in vaccination coverage results in 680 more autism cases, that autism has in fact been connected with vaccines through a couple of other studies just last year. There is just mountains of information that contradicts the mainstream views and primary vaccine policy and law, and we need to have and to preserve an open forum in which these ideas can be discussed, and perhaps most importantly, a place where we can eventually, in an open way, sift and sort through and distinguish between what's medical politics and what's medical science. The final distinction I asked the committee to consider was that this was not a referendum on vaccination, and yet that's how I think they're seeing it probably, and probably how people are presenting information. Vaccines are good or bad or whatever. And that's not really what they're considering. They were not talking about removing the mandate. They're just talking about whether or not to preserve an exception. And in order to preserve the conversation, as I said a few minutes ago, we really need to keep the philosophical exemption there. It's sort of a check and balance on, or at least allows for a check and balance on the influence of medical politics on medical science and healthcare policy.
I am here. Okay, so my question is, what was the, did you want to say anything else about that issue? Because I think it covered quite a good deal. Or do you want to go ahead and talk about a Natural News article, and then we can follow up with the veterinary talk about the rabies vaccine exemption and waiver, because Christina Chambreau had a lot to say about it in the previous show. She basically said that it's up to the township, and that the organization, the American Veterinary, what is it called? The American Veterinary Medical Association, really has no power at all. That was her conclusion. So maybe you have something other to say about that.
Well, sure. I can throw in a comment on the legal part. Let me just let folks know that a copy of the notes that I gave to the committee this morning in Vermont will be up on the website a little bit later today. Currently, I have already two letters posted that I have that I wrote at the request of a Vermont activist, and that got distributed to legislators when they were considering different aspects of this bill earlier in the process. And that's on the vaccinerights.com site. There's a policy and activism link on the homepage, and that'll take you to legislative projects and a list of the different state projects I've been involved with and the documents I've written on that. People can always email me to ask for copies of things or where to find them on my websites as well at attorney@vaccinerights.com. But let's talk about this Natural News article. Debbie, you brought this to my attention, and this is fascinating. You wanna dive in on this one first? Debbie, are you there?
Hold on. I send you so many things. I don't know which one you're talking about. Which one is it specifically?
Oh, this is the one. I'm sorry. This is one about vaccination theory. The title of the article on Natural News just in the last couple of days, Bedrock of Vaccination Theory Crumbles as Science Reveals Antibodies Not Necessary to Fight Viruses.
Okay. Yeah.
This was very interesting.
Thank you. Okay, I just found it. So yeah, I'll start the first paragraph and then we'll take it from there. While the medical, pharmaceutical, and vaccine industries are busy pushing new vaccines for practically every condition under the sun, and you know, you've recently read about many new ones for all kinds of diseases, a new study published in the journal Immunity completely deconstructs the entire vaccination theory. It's pretty good that it's in an immunity journal. It turns out that the body's natural immune systems, comprised of both innate and adaptive components, work together to ward off disease without the need for antibody-producing vaccines. So go ahead and give us your take on what's happening here, because I think the medical science is going to have to change.
Well, it's really interesting. And, you know, Debbie, I tend to not want to bring purely medical issues into this show just because my focus is on the legal issues and I don't have a medical background. But this one relates to some of my own past research in the issue here. An article I wrote originally many years ago and then did revisions of it over a period of years called Dispelling Vaccination Myths. I had found information about a rare condition in some children called agammaglobulin anemia. These are children who are not capable of producing antibodies. And yet, they recover from infectious diseases almost as quick as other children. So this study from years ago is one that seems to really support what we're seeing in this new study in immunity, the idea that, well, wait a second, antibodies are not the end-all and be-all of immunity here. In fact, again, according to this recognition in children, it may not even be absolutely necessary, a necessary component of immunity. There was another study published by the British Medical Council in 1950 during a diphtheria epidemic, and they concluded that there was no relationship between antibody count and disease incidence. They found resistant people with extremely low antibody counts, and sick people with very high antibody counts. So just the opposite of what you would expect if antibody production had a direct correlation to immunity or ability to fight off disease. So we've had, you know, information of this nature from many, many years ago, and it's absolutely wonderful to see that somebody is perhaps taking this a step further. And this is the first time I had seen someone use these particular terms, talking about both an innate and adaptive components to the immune system. But it is fascinating. And the theory in this new article, according to the Natural News article, the new study, is that the theory of vaccines is that they mimic infection by spurring B cells. And that's just one of two major types of white blood cells in the immune system to produce antibodies. And that's part of the adaptive immune system. And it's widely believed that these vaccine-induced antibodies teach the immune system how to directly respond to an infection before the body becomes exposed to it. That's the basic commonly held belief about vaccines. But the new research highlights, as the Natural News article goes on to tell us, that the innate immunity plays a significant role in fighting infections and maybe even a more important one than the adaptive immunity component. This is sort of rewriting the mainstream view of vaccine-induced antibodies as a sound way to protect us from disease.
Well, in terms of a homeopathic, holistic type of a viewpoint, it's important that the body itself strengthen its immune system through the defense mechanisms that it has naturally built into it, such as having a fever. This is actually a very good sign that your body is working properly, and we don't want to suppress that fever unless it gets too dangerously high. And therefore, having all of these other components in the body, I don't know how that really works to suppress the body's own defense mechanisms to get into action, to have a fever. I wanted to, if I may, also mention that Dr. Waqar Ali Khan of Florida has always been an active participant in Homeopathy World Community, bringing lots of news into our community. And so he has recently said, new heroin drug vaccine in the making. And, you know, the trend in medicine is to find a vaccine to cure every single possible ill, whether it is overweight, obesity, addictions to heroin, as in this case, epidemic disease, contagious disease like the influenza and swine flu, and all these recombinant thing genes that they're trying to put into these vaccines. They're making up these cocktails, and in truth, I don't think they know what it does in the body, not only on the short term, but over the course of a person's lifetime, in terms of what happens for chronic disease. Dr. Chambreau gave an example where they gave a medicine to a pet, and to suppress the cat, I think it was the cat licking, instead the cat got diabetes. Well, take your choice. What are we going to do about increasing the amount of diseases that we have to overcome by using all of these vaccines?
Well, part of the problem comes by the medical care being a for-profit industry, and you don't make money off of well people, first of all. So there's no incentive to actually cure people. There's great incentive to treat them in a way that allows you to, whether intentionally or not, perpetuate the disease or a disease or some disease condition. It's unfortunate would be a polite word for it, though, that we have this contradictory goal to maximize profit and supposedly to maximize health. Those are inconsistent goals. And so there's going to be, I mean, every man, woman, and child on the planet is a potential recipient of vaccines from the moment of birth until they take their last breath. And they'll probably come up with a casket vaccine they can give you after death, that the way they're going right now. So,
your body won't get sick in the casket
or something. But
well, they do put formaldehyde in it, don't they?
Yeah, but, you know, you need a vaccine to make sure that formaldehyde works. I don't know. They'll come up with something. But obviously we're being facetious here. But the point is that there is enormous disincentive to see, find, look for, or acknowledge problems with vaccines. And here in the United States, despite our economic woes, we're one of the richest nations on the planet, and we have one of the higher populations of countries in the world, and we have laws that make this is a pun I wish I didn't have to make, but the vaccine manufacturers are immune from liability. Where could you have a better deal? Wow, here's one of the wealthier nations, one of the larger nations. They have to get our products. It's mandated, and we don't have to do a darn thing if anything goes wrong with our product. The government buys the vaccines. The government pays for the industry. Of course, that means us and the taxpayers. I mean, it's a gold mine. Who could possibly ask for a better situation? So if anybody dispels the myths about vaccines being the end-all and be-all to infectious disease prevention and control, there's an enormous, enormous industry that will come crashing down right away, and a lot of people who will be very unhappy and are very unhappy about anybody who's saying anything or doing anything that threatens that enormous industry. We see the same thing, for example, there's a huge multi-billion dollar cancer industry. That industry will come crashing down when the already available cures for cancer become widely known, widely acknowledged, and widely utilized. But there
right,
is tremendous, so, you know, mm-hmm. again, tremendous disincentive to allow anything that really works to come under the spotlight.
It's as if those are closed systems that have been working so well for them that they're not going to puncture and burst that bubble. And I would like to, and I always do like to say, if all of the funding, the billions of dollars that were going into this development of vaccines or cancer drugs, chemotherapy, radiation, all of that stuff, if that money was funneled into improving society, improving sanitation, giving people better nutrition, and providing good meals and relationship building and things like that, we would be on our way to so much better life. And the fact that all of these diseases might be stemming from types of pollution, if we were spending all of that money on cleaning up the environment and getting rid of chemicals and providing more natural areas for people to breathe healthy air and drink healthy water, clean water, we would really be improving not only the planet, we would improve humanity on a whole range of places. People would not be feeling like they have to fight or struggle against each other if they felt that their basic needs were being met.
Yes, if we could eliminate pollution and poverty, we would transform the world.
Right. That's really where we should be focusing our attention and
spending our money.
Yeah. And, you know, every time we pay taxes, it's getting to be that time of year. My husband and I, we frown to think that our dollars are going into war and killing machines instead of going into really helping the planet.
You know, I'd rather have no taxes and just have a toll booth every time I get on the highway. You know, we should pay for the highways. We should pay for, you know, a lot of the things that we take for granted that comes from tax dollars. It's not that there isn't anything good from tax dollars, but boy, if we could decide how to allocate our own tax dollars, or if we could only pay for those benefits that of government that we actually utilize. Of course, you know, that would mean a lot of benefits couldn't be provided at all, because a lot of benefits go to people who can't afford to take care of themselves. And so we want to have government there as a safety net to catch those people. So there is a certain collective, and I think appropriately so, collectivism or collective mentality that goes on to this. You know, should all of us as a whole provide a safety net for those who, for whatever combination of reasons, need to have that net to catch them? But we won't solve that one in the remaining 5 or so minutes we have in the show today. But, fascinating article.
We can talk longer if you wish. It's up to you. I know you have to get on with your day. So,
yeah, I do. I have to finish at the regular time today. But let's talk. Tell us about the veterinary thing you said, and what issues were brought up in the last show, and I'll see if I can throw in a legal piece or two to help round out the discussion.
Okay. Well, the news was the AVMA, American Veterinary Medical Association, Executive Board passes an annual rabies vaccine waiver, and basically, Dr. Christina Chambreau said there's always been a waiver and this doesn't change anything at all. The news that is the AVMA recognizes some animals might require a waiver from rabies vaccination because the vaccination poses an unacceptably high risk to the health of the individual animal, quote unquote. And this is permission granted to CrossPost by Dr. Patricia Jordan. And that was what you had sent to me, a resolution number 2 dated 2012. And basically, Christina said there's nothing new here, that they've always had a insert saying that if the vaccines are only good to give to healthy animals. So I'm not exactly sure why this is a kudos for us. What is the real benefit to this particular resolution?
Well, I'm going to guess, because I really don't know, and I wasn't able to listen in on the previous show, but I'm going to guess that, is it Christine?
Dr. Christina Chambreau.
Dr. Chambreau. That Dr. Chambreau's concern or statement about this doesn't really do anything is based on the reality that this position by this organization, or this statement by this organization, doesn't have the power of law behind it. In other words, let's use the analogy with people. The CDC makes all kinds of recommendations about what vaccines people, kids should get or adults should get and so forth. But whether or not we actually have to get them depends on what the applicable laws say. And for most of us who are state residents, as opposed to, say, someone in the military overseas or in some other federal jurisdiction, it's going to be up to the individual state governments to decide. And potentially with rabies, maybe even in some infectious disease matters, there is authority in some instances at the county health department level or other localized levels. So it really depends. But I would disagree with respectfully with Dr. Chambreau on that position as an absolute. I think it is very good news, not because, as perhaps she and I would agree, it doesn't change the law, because it doesn't, but because when you have a formal national reputable agency taking a position, then that gives you ammunition that we can then take to state legislatures and say, you know, we really should have a law here that provides for an exemption. Now, I read an article a few months ago, and I have this posted on the vaccinerights.com website, that listed several states, I think there was about a dozen, that they said already have a medical exemption for dogs on the books. And that was quite a surprise to me, because I wasn't aware prior to reading that article of any medical exemptions for animals. So I thought it was a very enlightening piece of information for me. But what this does then, on the one hand, it doesn't change the laws, and so it does nothing. But on the other hand, what it does is open a door for more people and ultimately more state legislatures to consider laws allowing for that. Now, there'll be the same kind of pros and cons with, you know, on a bill to allow more medical exemptions for animals. And I think some of the exemptions are just for dogs. And so you're going to say, well, what about cats and gerbils or anything else? I guess cats and dogs are the primary pets that are required to be vaccinated. But it's a step in a direction. So it's a political win, even if it's not yet a legal win. And maybe that would be the quick way to sum it up. But there's a sad reality, and Debbie, you and I were talking about this earlier before the show today. Pets, under the law, are considered to be personal property. And, of course, we all think of our pets as being part of the family. I always have in the past when I've had pets, and I'm sure listeners do. But let's keep in mind, as just a legal technicality, to know, you know, keep it on the back burner in case you need it at any point, that legally pets being considered property, personal property, we're not going to see religious or philosophical exemptions for pets, at least not in the foreseeable future. They're just not going to fall under any exemptions for humans. And, of course, they don't have personal and philosophical and religious beliefs in any way that we can document that would support enactment of exemptions for the animals themselves. Of course, we, the owners, are going to be the ones making that decision. So I don't think we're going to see freedom of choice with vaccines and pets unless and until some future point where, if it were to eventually happen, that vaccines as we know it today are considered to be just simply never mandatory, period. I think we will eventually reach that point, but I think that's from this particular point, quite a ways down the road. So, but a stepping stone in that direction is acknowledging that there are medical bases for allowing pets, at least some pets, to forego vaccines. So it's a movement in the right direction, and I think this decision helps to feed the awareness that keeps us moving in that direction.
I agree with you there, and I feel that whatever we learn about the reaction that pets have to vaccinations, they are the literal guinea pigs to vaccines that are mandated annually or every so many years. And the number of pets that there are, millions of pets that require vaccines, and when we see the responses of whether it's bone damage or diabetes or other disease, we can think of that as what are we doing when humans get vaccines. And maybe that is something that we can use as information for whether we determine whether humans need vaccines if our pets don't need them or cause harm.
Well, may the conversation continue and okay. See more and more of the light of day.
Okay, well, we're going to end today's show. I want to thank you for getting on an extra long show today. We've had so many great things to talk about, and I want to say we'll be back next Thursday with you at noon. Previous to that show is Dr. Christina Chambrow at 11 a.m. on Thursday with Pet Health. We're going to be talking about I think we decided to talk, I'm not sure, about diabetes for one of the following show. And let's see, on Monday evening we have Grant Bentley coming on with facial analysis. On Monday at 11 a.m. is the brand new live video stream channel with Dr. Deepak Sharma. And we had started talking about dreams of snakes. We're going to continue with that and the influences of society on our dreams. Then we were going to talk about Wednesday morning Dr. Adil Chimthalawala Kasim is on vacation. Really, he's working to teach many students, and he'll be back at the end of April. Those are all of our shows, and we appreciate everyone who tweets, shares, puts it on Facebook, and gets the word out by sending an email to friends. So we're going to end today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Light your inner candle and never die.